please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Round the world with reporters.
Children and Armed Conflict in Yemen 2021 was the title of the recent report of the Secretary General of the United Nations. In a press conference held by Yemen's Ministry of Human Rights, Yemen government discussed the UN report and how children protection could be achieved.
For years now, we have been used to see the United Nations doing the opposite of what it should do regarding the crimes of the Saudi-led coalition. This report in itself is considered a war crime against the children of Yemen. It was clear from the first day of the war in Yemen that the United Nations seeks to legitimize war and crimes.
The ministry said the report of the United Nations is full of inaccuracies and doesn't rely on any investigation on the ground, adding that the report aims to legitimize the Saudi war crimes against Yemeni children.
The most serious inaccuracy in the recent United Nations report is that it zeroed the number of crimes committed by the Saudi-led coalition countries and did not mention any of their crimes. Unfortunately, the United Nations accused the Yemeni army of targeting more than 7,000 children, and these numbers are incorrect. The United Nations didn't explain where it has got these statistics from.
Saudi Arabia, backed by Washington, launched a devastating war on Yemen in March 2015. During the war years, Riyadh has committed numerous violations of international law, including using internationally prohibited weapons in its air raids, which have killed tens of thousands of civilians, most of them women and children.
Besides the ongoing Saudi siege that prevents millions of Yemenis, including children, from getting food, medicine and fuel, Saudi airstrikes have also killed more than 4,000 Yemeni children alone, according to rights organizations. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Demonstrations against Palestinian Authority over the death of Nizar Banat, an activist and outspoken critic of the PA, keep going on across the occupied West Bank. In the city of Ramallah, these protests turned violent as the protesters who began to march to presidential compound faced a group of PA president's security officers in plain clothes. The forces blocked the rally, chased and attacked the protesters who were chanting slogans against the PA and its president. Palestinian security forces in riot gear fired tear gas and stun grenades to disperse the protesters. Palestinian factions condemned the use of force against the protesters, saying people have the right to peacefully protest.
The people see that the investigation is slow and that the Palestinian Authority has not yet condemned the killing of Nizar Banat. So people are taking to the streets to ensure those behind Banat's death are put on trial.
Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Ishtayi said an investigation was launched to investigate Banat's death. Palestinians are demanding a swift, independent, and a transparent investigation. Palestinian rights group made an initial autopsy saying that Banat took blows to the head and the wounds indicated an unnatural death.
We need to take some practical steps within law that require justice, investigation and accountability for those behind Nizar Banat's death. We say there is a need to dismiss this government as well as the heads of the security forces.
Journalists were also attacked by security forces during the protests. The Palestinian Journalists Union decried the grave development in the attack on freedom of expression and the media. Journalists, meanwhile, say condemnation is not enough. They say the attack is unacceptable and should be investigated in order to hold those responsible accountable.
Commentators say that what's going on today is only the tip of the iceberg. They say if the Palestinian Authority wants to prevent a possible collapse, it should bring those perpetrators into justice and allow people to freely protest and express their opinion. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
On June 25, 1950, the Korean War broke out as the North Korean army poured across the 38th parallel into South Korea. The anniversary Friday provided a marker for reflection. The war memorial here in the center of the South Korean capital is part of ongoing multifaceted efforts to promote the military. Here, honoring those who served and died in the Korean War, South Koreans, Americans, and other nationalities. But the 1950-53 conflict was only suspended with an armistice, not a peace treaty. And because of the tension with North Korea, South Korea requires all able-bodied men to serve a year and a half in the armed forces. More and more South Koreans are not buying into the rhetoric of militaristic antagonism. Activist Shin Jae-uk this week launched an online museum, a group effort exposing disturbing aspects of the Korean War with previously restricted material.
The War Memorial Hall was established in the name of patriotism education to extol anti-communist ideology. It is centered on generals and heroes, not ordinary soldiers or civilians, and is belligerent about war and glorifies it.
Documents in the exhibit confirm the U.S. military's use of napalm in the Korean War and suspicions that a South Korean general destroyed a bridge across the Han River, preventing thousands of civilians from retreating.
This exhibit is about the stories of people who are hidden behind the ideology that national security is most important. It comes from the perspective of war victims. We want to let people know that war is not allowed, and there is no just war in the world. And when war breaks out, people are forced to die this way.
Some 2.3 million people were killed during the Korean War, often called the Forgotten War or the Never-Ending War. Frank Smith, Seoul.
The month of Tir on the Iranian calendar marks a series of tragic events that occurred during the early years of the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution. From the U.S. Army's shooting down of an Iranian airliner in 1988 to the 1981 bombing of the headquarters of the Iran Islamic Republic Party in Tehran by the U.S.-backed Mujahideen-e-Khalq terror group are examples of the incidents that fall in the same time frame, between late June and early July.
The U.S. footprints can be traced in almost all of the incidents that occurred during this period. The events were so harsh and fateful that are still remembered by Iranians after decades. Every year, Iran marks June the 26th to July the 2nd as the week of American human rights, as a jab that questions the U.S. standing as rights advocate.
The week-long occasion is associated with nationwide ceremonies. Each day commemorates one of the incidents. The first day marks the attempted assassination of the then-president Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei by the MKO terrorists in 1981. The second day marks the bombing of the headquarters of the Iran Islamic Republic Party in Tehran in the same year. 73 leading officials of the Islamic Republic were killed, including former Justice Chief Ayatollah Muhammad Ali Beheshti. The event is known in Iran as the 7th of Tir disaster. This incident was also carried out by the MKO terror group. In 2012, the United States removed the MKO from the list of terrorist organizations, something which is interpreted as Washington's dual take on terrorism.
The United States' hostility toward Iran became more evident after the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979. It supported Iraq's Saddam Hussein in his war against Iran, and also funded and supported the MKO terrorists in numerous attacks on Iranian people. So we reviewed these incidents during this week to let the world know that the U.S. is not a defender of human rights.
The week also marks Iraq's 1987 chemical attack on the city of Sardasht in West Azerbaijan province. During the eighth-year Iraqi-imposed war on Iran, at least 110 people were killed and 5,000 more were injured in the attack, which was carried out using chemical weapons provided by the U.S. and some other Western countries.
The chemical bombardment of Sardasht was one of the most heinous crimes against humanity. Sardasht was the third city after Japan's Hiroshima and Nagasaki to become the target of weapons of mass destruction. Former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein possessed a huge arsenal of chemical weapons, which were produced using materials supplied by the U.S. and other Western countries.
Observers say Washington portrays itself as the defender of human rights across the globe, but it uses the issue as an excuse to exert pressure on other countries, while closing its eyes on its own rights violations. Organizers hope the week-long ceremonies will help shine a light on the U.S.'s double standards when it comes to the issue of human rights. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Former U.S. police officer Derek Chauvin has been sentenced to 22 and a half years in prison for the murder of African-American George Floyd during an arrest in May 2020 in the city of Minneapolis. This came after a jury found 45-year-old Chauvin guilty on April 20th of unintentional second-degree murder, third-degree murder, and second-degree manslaughter. President Joe Biden reacted to the court's decision, saying the prison sentence seemed to be appropriate. But civil rights activists, as well as members of Floyd's family, had a different point of view.
This sentencing is the longest sentence we've seen, but it is not justice, because George Floyd is in a grave tonight, even though Chauvin will be in jail.
When you think about George being murdered in cold blood with a knee on his neck for 9 minutes and 29 seconds, execution style in broad daylight, 22 and a half years is not enough.
This right here is this 22-year sentence they gave this man. It's a slap on the wrist. We serving a life sentence of not having them in our life, and that hurts me to death.
We didn't get what we wanted. We definitely wanted to see the maximum penalty, but however, as they've already stated, we do have the federal ahead of us.
Experts say Chauvin's trial was a stunt to distract African Americans from their main demands.
I think what we're seeing here is more bait and switch and distraction. When they focus, and the media is complicit in this, the U.S. corporate media, because what they do when they focus on trials like this, they're trying to distract what the ultimate goal and the primary goal of the movements, the uprisings, are.
The video of the white officer kneeling on the neck of the unarmed black man in handcuffs for more than 9 minutes sparked outrage in the U.S. and around the world. However, Floyd was just one of thousands of black victims murdered by U.S. police. According to research and advocacy group Mapping Police Violence, nearly 7,800 people were killed by police in the United States from 2013 to 2020. A disproportionate number of victims were African Americans. The group says black Americans are 2.5 times as likely to be killed by police as white people. Meanwhile, inspired by the verdict in George Floyd's case, relatives of other police brutality victims in the U.S. have also come forward demanding their cases reopened. But as many see the recent court ruling against the murderer of Floyd far from proportional to the crime he has committed, justice in the U.S. society seems to remain as elusive as ever.
Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah began his televised speech by denouncing the U.S. administration's decision to seize and block dozens of website domains connected to Iranian and regional media outlets.
It's not coincidental that these websites which were seized are media outlets that had a major role in supporting the Palestinians in the Sword of Al-Quds battle. They all have a clear position from the Zionist enemy and the American hegemony over the region. These outlets are critical of sedition and terrorism, specifically Takfiri terrorism. This gives us and the free people of the world another piece of evidence against the false claims of the U.S. administration, which claims to defend freedom of speech and freedom of opinion.
Said Nasrallah also criticized U.S. statements that attempt to incite the Lebanese army against the resistance. Said Nasrallah noted that U.S. officials have tried to justify their humble support to the Lebanese army by stressing that this assistance is aimed at giving the army leverage to confront Hezbollah. This, Said Nasrallah says, will not happen since the National Army is the main guarantor for peace in the country. On another note, the resistance leader explained how Hezbollah has been exerting an effort to mediate talks for the formation of the cabinet.
All efforts in the country must come together to form a government and to pull the country out of this dilemma. Since Prime Minister-designate Saad Hariri was named by most members of parliament, we have been working on a quick formation of the cabinet. We have been supportive of an initiative from Speaker Berry, and we will work on finding resolutions to the last few disagreements in the talks.
Experts believe Said Nasrallah's words and sufferings of the people lining up at gas stations and pharmacies should be an incentive for the officials to find solutions.
Sayed Nasrallah said there is no magical solution, and he stressed that the crisis should be disintegrated and resolved one by one until the government is reestablished. If we want to go back to the state where the government collects taxes and the citizens practice their rights and responsibilities in paying taxes, where there are investments in the country again and we create more job opportunities, all of these issues need political stability, and political stability will be the only first step to genuinely solve the many crises in the country.
Sayed Nasrallah has stressed that Hezbollah has accomplished all the administrative and logistic preparations for importing gasoline and fuel from Iran to Lebanon in case the state fails to cover the fuel shortage. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Luxurious Avonfield apartments located at Park Lane, Mayfair in London. The family of thrice-elected former Prime Minister of Pakistan, Nawaz Sharif, has been staying here for decades. A trial court sentenced Nawaz Sharif for 10 years in 2018 for owning these flats, which the judge found were purchased through money laundering and ill-gotten money. Sharif left Pakistan in late 2019 after being released, allegedly on the basis of false medical reports, to once again reside in this palatial residence. To the shock of the former Prime Minister, back in Pakistan, now a high court set aside his appeal and upheld the verdict of the trial court. Sharif was declared a fugitive of law by the court when he backtracked his commitment with the high court to return home within a few weeks after the medical treatment. This has now led High Court to reject his appeal for failing to return home despite his earlier pledge with the court.
I think Nawaz Sharif should not have fled the country and now that he has been declared as fugitive or an absconder, that's not good for him. That will actually soil his political reputation. For now, you know, Nawaz Sharif is in trouble and politically, I think, his position has become more precarious.
The High Court verdict has come as a major political victory for ruling party of Prime Minister Imran Khan, who came into power in 2018 with the pledge to prosecute Nawaz Sharif and other opposition leaders on corruption charges.
This verdict is a victory for the people of Pakistan, and this verdict is the victory to the ruling party's anti-corruption campaign. We believe Nawaz Sharif must return the money he looted from the people of Pakistan.
The former Prime Minister still has one chance to appeal with the Supreme Court of Pakistan to set aside his conviction. But for that to happen, Sharif must return home. Otherwise, legal experts believe that the top court may also reject his appeal. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Shocking footage filmed on the 18th of June, Iran's election day, shows Iranian expats being attacked outside polling stations up and down the UK. Victims included women and the elderly, the perpetrators, supporters of anti-Iran terrorist groups, including the MEK, communists, and Shah royalists.
Videos released on social media show fanatic protesters hurling Islamophobic abuse and even physically assaulting voters in cities including Birmingham, Manchester and here in London too.
One victim reached out to tell us about her ordeal.
As soon as I got near the embassy, I was wearing the hijab, obviously, and the crowd started roaring and screaming. And they got louder as they saw me, obviously, going to vote. Calling me names, calling my family names, cursing my mother, my father. I heard a rock hit the ground. I didn't look back because I was shaking at that time as well. One of them said to me, and funnily enough, the policeman was there, but obviously he couldn't understand Farsi. He was telling me if I had a knife, I would cut you in pieces right here, right now. I was so shaking. Yeah. Since then, I've suffered with anxiety since that day. I said to myself, I should have left. But I stood my ground. I said, why should I leave? And the people coming, I said, why are you calling me names? They said, we call you names because you deserve it.
Britain boasts about being a defender of democracy on the world stage.
But these violent scenes suggest that the UK failed miserably to protect democratic rights of Iranians inside its own borders. Despite these attempts, Iran's election went ahead with President-elect Sayed Ibrahim Raisi coming out on top. Robert Carter, London.
It's the world's second most populous nation, and the figures of COVID-19 infection cases are rising on a daily basis. The cities are bustling as the country is picking up pace as the world's fastest growing major economies. But in all this hustle bustle and race of survival, an important aspect of life is on stake, and that is mental health. The second wave of COVID-19 has altered the lifestyle of millions across India who now are struggling in silence. Reports suggest more than 70% of those in the age group of 18 to 24 are suffering from some form of depression. Now, the COVID-19 pandemic has ignited the crisis further as many are facing financial and social hardships. According to psychological experts, economic and social pressures combined with the lack of appropriate mental health facilities is a major reason behind this new epidemic, which has now started exploding due to the coronavirus pandemic. Based on reports, the economic cost of mental illness in India is expected to be more than $1 trillion by 2030.
COVID-19 has impacted a lot. A lot means, you can say, almost everyone, because one or the other way, everyone has been affected, whether it's, the infection has caused or the mental health or the other ways, because the businesses has shut down.
Health experts say all disorders are linked to a fast-paced lifestyle, stress, complexities of living, breakdown of support systems, and challenges of economic instability. They say the COVID pandemic has added fuel to the fire with depression, anxiety disorders, schizophrenia, psychotic disorders, and substance abuse being common in most people.
One must go for yoga daily. Yoga, you have to do proper yoga. Then breathing exercises are there. They have to do at least half an hour to 1 hour so that the blood circulation towards brain increases.
COVID-19 lockdowns impacted people from all walks of life and age groups. Now they're finding it hard to deal with consequences of the pandemic-induced lockdowns. Many turn to drugs and alcohol, while others prefer religious therapies and yoga. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
The Limelight.
Marine Le Pen's far-right party has suffered a serious electoral blow when it failed to win a regional election in its stronghold in southern France. The Rassemblement National has pinned its last chances on taking the Provence-Alpes-Côte d'Azur region after emerging victorious from last week's first-round vote, although by a small margin. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian journalist Kim Wilshire. The piece is titled Le Pen's far-right party suffers blow in French regional elections. Marine Le Pen's far-right party has suffered a serious electoral blow when it failed to win a regional election in its stronghold in southern France. The Rassemblement National has pinned its last chances on taking the Provence-Alpes-Côte d'Azur region after emerging victorious from last week's first-round vote, albeit by a small margin. However, an alliance of rival parties formed a Republican front against the Rassemblement National, RN, including the withdrawal of the Socialist Party and left-wing alliance candidate, and that prevented the far right from taking the region. Sunday's result was a final bitter disappointment for the Rassemblement National RN, which had been predicted to do well in at least five regions in the first round vote last Sunday, 20th of June. In the end, the Rassemblement National came first only in the Provence-Alpes-Côte d'Azur region, and then only by a narrow margin. Exit polls suggested that the Les Républicains candidate in PACA, Renaud Muselier, had polled a convincing 56.6% of votes against the Rassemblement National RM's Thierry Mariani's 43.4%. Afterwards, Marine Le Pen said local democracy was suffering a profound crisis and criticized unnatural alliances made between political rivals to confound a Rassemblement National RN victory and prevent us from showing that we can win a region. In a brief but defiant post-election speech, Marine Le Pen added that the abstention rate showed a discontentment among electors that was a major signal for all political class and society in France. While many saw these elections as a warm-up for next year's presidential election, neither of the supposed 2022 leadership front-runners, Emmanuel Macron or Marine Le Pen, have been left with much to celebrate. Abstention was again a major factor in the local election. Despite appeals by politicians and the French Prime Minister Jean Castex for voters to turn out, almost two-thirds of French electors shunned the polling stations in regional elections on Sunday, 27th of June. For the first round, on Sunday, 20th of June, there was a record 66.74% abstention. This time, just under 66% of voters failed to turn out. Political analysts said the lack of interest in the regional elections is because France has become focused on the presidential election next year and the legislative elections that follow shortly afterwards. Philippe Ballard, who stood for the Rassemblement National RN in the Île-de-France region, insisted the far-right party was increasing its popularity in the country, and this will be played out in next year's leadership race. Stanislaw Guérini, MP for Emmanuel Macron's governing La République En Marche, the LREM, admitted the results were also a disappointment for the governing party that failed to win a single region. Stanislaw Guérini said, "We have work to do." He rejoiced that, in fact, the Rassemblement National, RN, had not gained any region either. Xavier Bertrand, a former minister when Nicolas Sarkozy was president, who was re-elected in the Hauts-de-France with 52.8% of the vote, saw his hopes of representing the mainstream right in next year's presidential election boosted. This is the first election since France's electoral map was redrawn in 2016, when the country's 22 regions were reduced to 13. The main winners appear to be mainstream left Parti Socialiste and left-wing allies, and the centre-right Les Républicains. Both parties have been absent from the French political landscape since Emmanuel Macron's centrist La République En Marche election success in 2017. The first round of regional elections on Sunday, 20th of June, resulted in a drubbing for Emmanuel Macron's ruling party and disappointment for Marine Le Pen's far-right party, and a record low turnout with two-thirds of the voters effectively shunning the polls. For some observers, the outcome of the 20th of June first round raised doubts over whether the 2022 presidential election would come down to a duel between the president, Emmanuel Macron, and Marine Le Pen in a runoff long seen as the most likely scenario. The first round results were a boost for the traditional right-wing Les Républicains as well as the Socialist Party, who have been squeezed after the centrist Macron surged into power in 2017 with his new La République En Marche party.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The debate.
Once again, targets in Iraq has been hit in its border with Syria. Iraq has condemned the U.S. airstrikes as a violation of its sovereignty and national security. Why would the U.S. target the legitimate forces of Iraq that it calls illegitimate, accusing them of targeting U.S. forces? This is the second time that the U.S. under Joe Biden has made the decision to strike Iraq. Will this risk a war between U.S. forces and the PMU forces? Stay tuned to the debate.
The Pentagon confirmed it carried out airstrikes in positions of Iraq's popular mobilization units on both sides of the country's border with Syria. The Pentagon claimed the Sunday night strikes were defensive and in retaliation for what it called the PMU's drone attacks on U.S. personnel and facilities in Iraq. But the PMU forces roundly rejected any involvement. They said they are part of Iraq's regular armed forces and that the soldiers who died in the U.S. raids were guarding the border. The PMU forces warned that they are ready to take revenge. The U.S. airstrikes are the second of their kind to be ordered by President Joe Biden against the PMU since he took office in January. Biden says the strikes are meant to end what he calls for forces attacks on U.S. interests, but Iraqis see things differently.
The Iraqi people, government, officials, factions, and political figures see this attack as a boon to Daesh and other terrorists in Iraq and Syria. Through this attack, the U.S. seeks to weaken PMU forces in Iraqi and Syrian border areas so that Daesh terrorists can enter the Iraqi territory and carry out terrorist attacks. Effectively, the U.S. is now standing united with Daesh against the people of Iraq and its interests.
The strikes have been condemned across the political spectrum in Iraq. Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi denounced the airstrikes as a blatant and unacceptable violation of Iraq's sovereignty and its national security. The Iraqi military also issued a rare statement saying the U.S. move was a breach of the country's sovereignty. Different factions in the Iraqi parliament also condemned the airstrikes and called for steps to ensure such attacks will not repeat. They say the solution is ending the U.S. military presence in Iraq. That would be in line with a resolution adopted by the Iraqi parliament in January 2020, which called on the government to end the presence of all foreign troops in the country. The Iraqi parliament passed a resolution days after the U.S. assassinated Iran's top general Qasem Soleimani, along with a deputy commander of the PMU forces, Abu Mehdi al-Mohandes, in an airstrike near Baghdad airport. The U.S. has carried out more airstrikes on PMU positions ever since. During the period, Daesh terrorists have been the only other perpetrator of attacks on the popular forces.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Debate, Senior Research Fellow at the Global Policy Institute, George Samieli, joins us from Budapest. And we also have writer and political analyst John White joining us from Edinburgh. I'd like to welcome you both. John White, let me first go to you and ask you about the U.S. version of what has happened, in which it said the U.S. military targeted operational and weapons storage facilities at two locations in Syria and one in Iraq in response to drone attacks by what the U.S. calls militia against U.S. personnel and facilities in Iraq.
Well, the U.S. presence of countries is entirely in violation of international law. They are not there at the invitation of the legally constituted governments of both countries. Indeed, on the contrary, they're there at the with the opposition of both governments. So they are an occupying force, and therefore their presence in both countries is illegal. Now, it seems clear to me that the Biden administration, it constitutes no step change from the previous Trump administration or the previous Obama administration. It's a case of meet the new boss, same as the old boss. The only difference is one of approach. So this was a vile act of international brigandage and piracy against popular mobilization units in Iraq, who have been the only thing standing between Iraq's sovereignty and status as a secular state and the black flag of ISIS or Salafi jihadism flying over Baghdad. It's a disgrace. It's not in keeping with the trajectory of the region, which is towards an axis of resistance against US imperialism and all its conceits.
Well, Joe Savinelli, the U.S. Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, has said their airstrikes against what he calls Iran-backed militias in Iraq and Syria over the weekend were a necessary, and I'm quoting him, and appropriate action meant to limit the risk of escalation. How does that limit the risk of escalation?
Well, of course, it doesn't limit the risk of escalation in any way whatsoever. It's very amusing that the United States keeps repeating this mantra of, well, this is a proportionate response against Iran-backed militia, and that the United States is present in Iraq legally, and the only reason why it's in Iraq is that it is fighting ISIS. Now, of course, as my colleague has just pointed out, and the forces that are fighting ISIS the most effectively have been the forces that the United States has just struck, these so-called Iran-backed militia. And of course, the forces that have been fighting ISIS the least effectively have been the forces by the United States. Now, of course, the United States is not present in Iraq legally. I mean, that's the point. I mean, the Pentagon statement and the statement of Anthony Blinken is completely false. The United States has no legal justification for being in Iraq. It was in January 2020, following the assassination of General Soleimani, that the Iraqi parliament demanded that the United States leave Iraq. The United States has not done so, has no intention of doing so. So it's, you know, the claim that somehow the United States is acting legally is completely false. And the rationale behind the strike, we're fighting the Iran-backed militia, is itself bogus, because these are the forces that are actually fighting ISIS the most effectively.
Okay, so if you don't mind, John White, holding on to that thought that the U.S. is not in Iraq legally, this is what the Prime Minister, Mustafa al-Kadhimi, has said along with the Iraqi army. We condemn, quote, the U.S. airstrike that targeted a site last night on the Iraqi-Syrian border, which represents a blatant and unacceptable violation of Iraqi sovereignty and Iraqi national security, according to all international conventions. Now, this is not the first time that this has happened, John White, and if the U.S. is in Iraq illegally, I'm wondering what the Iraqi officials actually are saying to the U.S., to the respective parties there in the U.S., like what the Prime Minister says, don't do it again, which the U.S. has done. I mean, what does Iraq say to the U.S., and what can the U.S. say in return?
Well, George Zemmour is absolutely correct. A vote was taken in the Iraqi parliament in 2020 to expel all U.S. officials, and the fact that they're still there, this proves beyond peradventure that this is not a democracy acting in the interest of democracy, it's an empire acting in the interests of empire. Obviously, the Iraqis don't have the power of the US, but there does have to come a stage where the UN intervenes to condemn resolutely and unreservedly US machinations in Iraq and in Syria. This is not about any administration. Everybody was blinded by Joe Biden's folksy approach to politics, and he was going to be a step change from Donald Trump. No. As I said earlier, this is just a difference in approach. The objective is the same, which is to maintain U.S. fading hegemony in the Middle East and on a wider level across the world. So that the tectonic plates of geopolitical and geostrategic power are shifting from the west to the east, and thus we are in a period of interregnum. And it's a very dangerous period because no empire leaves the stage of history without a hard-fought struggle. And this issue and this incident is part of that struggle. The Iraqi people, the Syrian people, are victims of this US empire, but I have confidence that before long, this US empire will cease to be a realistically strong force in the region. The people of the region have rejected them. It's only a matter of time before they understand that they have no longer any purchase in that region or anywhere else in the global south.
We have talked about, or touched on the fact, George Samueli, that Iraq has been able to defeat the Daesh terrorists. It was successful in doing that. And one of the reasons that it was able to do that was because of the PMU forces, the same forces that the U.S. keeps saying these are Iran-backed militias, of which it basically says they're illegitimate. And an observation here that I'd like to get your reaction on this, George Samueli, is that this attack took place the day after there was a major military parade which featured these PMU forces. And that was a grand parade, and it was really a show of force. Do you think that the timing of this has anything to do with that in terms of the U.S. choosing the day after this military parade took place?
Well, it's quite possible. I don't know that for a fact. But there's no question that the United States is desperate to ensure that any of the indigenous forces basically are unable to perform effectively. I mean, let's remember, there would have been no ISIS had there been no U.S. intervention in Iraq. And we know that from 2014 on, the Obama administration was looking on benignly as ISIS grew in power in Iraq and in Syria. We know this is a record of this, that we know that they were looking for ISIS to effect regime change in Iraq and regime change in Syria. And, you know, the United States only took the fight against ISIS seriously, if we can say, if we can even use the term seriously in this context, after President Putin announced in September 2015 that Russia was going to step in and take care of business with ISIS. And suddenly the Obama administration said, oh, yeah, we're in on this as well. But up until then, the United States was very, very happy to see the rise of ISIS, just as today the United States is the biggest protector of al-Qaeda in the Middle East, because it knows perfectly well that the biggest center of al-Qaeda forces is in Syria, in Idlib, and it continues to resist any attempt by the Syrian government and Russia to bring this al-Qaeda enclave to an end.
Okay, it was in December of this past year, John White, when the U.S. Actually made an announcement that it's going to withdraw its forces from Iraq. It never followed through on that, per se. Of course, we could always say that the U.S. never really pulls out any of its forces completely, like in the case of Afghanistan. Nevertheless, do you think that there's a possibility that the U.S., knowing that the Iraqi parliamentarians, many of them want the U.S. out, many officials want the U.S. out of Iraq, but the U.S. wants to stay there because of Syria, in order for there to be some geographic advantage in that sense. Is that a reason why you think the U.S. is steadfast in staying in Syria, in Iraq?
Absolutely. The U.S. has done its best to undermine the Syrian government throughout its long conflict with ISIS and other Salafi jihadi forces. If not for U.S. machination in Syria, Salafi jihadism would have been smashed long before now. The U.S. is also under pressure from its regional allies, Israel and Saudi Arabia, to maintain a presence in order to bolster their machinations in the region. And these are two sectarian states that have no interest in seeing Syria being stabilized, no interest in seeing Iraq being stabilized, because for them the behemoth in the region is Iran. And the only reason that these countries despise Iran, the only reason these countries have set their face against Iran, is nothing to do with Iran's domestic or internal issues or the nature of its state. Every country has its own domestic challenges. It's because Iran does not bow. That's the only reason. Iran is a target And the road to Tehran for the US and its regional allies leads through Damascus and Iraq.
Okay. George Samioli, in the bigger picture, the U.S. president, during his campaign pledges and even when he came into office, on different occasions has said, we're winding down the wars, in reference to, of course, Afghanistan first, and then looking at what is happening in particular in Iraq and then Syria, saying that, you know, they want to reduce not only their presence, but as recently as just weeks ago, it confirmed that it's reducing by 8 the number of Patriot anti-missile batteries in the Middle East, which consisted of hundreds of troops, aircraft, that they are removing or have removed. And this would be from Iraq, from Jordan, from Kuwait, and from Saudi Arabia. And, of course, their thing is with China, that it's a national security threat. They're going to focus on China and Russia. So then this, you know, strike comes, this is the second time now. It doesn't really look like they're going to disengage from this region, does it?
No, it really doesn't. And I think the key there is the role of Iran. Now, if you look at Iran, I mean, Iran has obviously been subject to consistent U.S. aggression since the Iranian Revolution. Iran has been subject to Israeli aggression for decades. And how does Iran resist? Well, obviously, Iran resists via its ballistic missile program, but it also resists via its proxy forces. And yeah, of course, it does have these proxy forces throughout the Middle East that it will initiate should there be a conflict between Iran and the United States or Iran and Israel. So these proxy forces, whether in Syria, whether it's in Iraq, whether it's in Lebanon, are absolutely vital to Iran's strategic interests. And of course, that's why Israel has been consistently targeting these forces and why the United States is anxious to target them, because they know that in any conflict with Iran, these, whatever you call them, these proxy Iran proxy forces will be a very important part of Iranian resistance.
Trying to figure out the role of Israel in this, John, if you can help me out. You know, we have noticed how Israel has time and again attacked Syria on a number of occasions. And quite interestingly, there's been a lull in that situation. But since we've talked about Iran and since the U.S. keeps referring to the PMU forces as being malicious backed or aligned by Iran, we're under the impression, however, that there's these nuclear negotiations that the Biden administration is saying they're focused on. And because of that, Pentagon has actually said that they see this window where they're if once that comes about and if there is an agreement, that they're going to refocus or put their focus onto that alleged China threat. How do you see it?
Well, they've really done their best to undermine the JCPOA, and they're doing their best under the new Prime Minister Naftali Bennett to undermine these talks in Vienna. This is one of the most weird coalitions of any Democrat or so-called Democratic government we've ever seen. They cannot stand the fact that Iran may return to being a power that can put its oil on the world markets and can have sanctions lifted, because for the Israelis, Iran is a menace that they cannot get rid of in their minds, because they understand that they are so vulnerable. Israel is a giant with feet of clay in the region. They're very vulnerable, and they see Iran as a country that will ultimately speed the way towards full Palestinian freedom, self-determination, and and the end of the Zionist project. That is what they fear most. Every Israeli government, regardless of who leads it, sees Iran as a direct threat to its expansionism, to its system of apartheid and ethnic cleansing and subjugation of the Palestinian people. So the Israelis are doing their best to lobby behind closed doors to the Biden administration, because the Biden administration has has articulated that it wants to have wants to refocus on a two-state solution, even though that's dead in the water. So Iran is the solution to the freedom of the Palestinian people. The Israelis understand that, and that's why they fear Iran so much, and that's why they get so hysterical when it comes to anything involving Iran.
Okay. George Samueli, so now we have this strike, the second one that has taken place. The group that's within the PMU forces, as it was reported, they have vowed revenge. They have vowed to take down any U.S. airplane that actually flies over Iraq. If something like that happens, and I know it's talking about something that hasn't happened yet, but hypothetically, do you think that this is going to mean war?
Well, I mean, there's war already ongoing. Yes, I think that if there is indeed a retaliation against U.S. forces, then the United States will escalate. I mean, it will escalate with attacks against Iraq. It will escalate with further attacks in Syria. I mean, what it's doing in Syria is already just, it's kind of almost, so it's beyond any kind of description in terms of just as humanity. I mean, the horrific sanctions and everything. But in the case of Syria, it has pretty much a blank check. No one, as far as American public opinion is concerned, no one complains about any U.S. actions in Syria. Iraq is a little bit different because, at least in the case of Iraq, the United States tries to make this pretense, however fraudulent, that it is in Iraq at the invitation of the Baghdad government, and it is ostensibly there in order to help it fight ISIS. Of course, it's absolutely bogus, but if there is an escalation of conflict in Iraq, then it's going to become ever more difficult to maintain this fiction. But, you know, the U.S. propaganda machine is so powerful that, you know, I wouldn't have believed that after what happened in January 2020, after the Iraqi parliament had asked the United States to leave, that the United States would just continue ignoring the wishes of the Iraqi parliament and still insist before the world, oh, we are here at the invitation of the Iraqi people, the very Iraqi people that have just been asked you to leave. So the U.S. propaganda machine is quite relentless in spreading fraud and lies.
Okay, thank you so much. We're going to end it there. That's Senior Research Fellow at Global Policy Institute, George Samueli. Thank you for your comments. Also, John White, thank you, from Edinburgh, writer and political analyst. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Debate. From Mikhail Tapway, entire team in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.